A day with a palindromic date. A day when someone new is coming. They're all excited, because they know it's got something to do with the big canvas bag that Miss Justineau brought in with her, and they can see that she's just as excited to show them what's inside. It's going to be a good day. One of the best days, probably. But it's Siobhan, in the end, who gets it. It's the first day of spring, she shouts from behind Melanie. Good for you, Siobhan, Miss Justineau says. Absolutely right. It's the 21st of March, and, for the part of the world where we live, that's... What? What's the big deal about the 21st? The first day of spring, Tom repeats. But Melanie, who's kicking herself for not seeing this sooner, knows that Miss Justineau is looking for more than that. It's the vernal equinox, she says quickly before anyone else can. Exactly, Miss Justineau agrees. Give the lady a big hand. It's the vernal equinox. Now, what does that mean? The kids all clamour to answer. Usually nobody bothers to tell them what date it is, and of course they never get to see the sky. But they're familiar with the theory. Ever since the solstice, way back in December, the nights have been getting shorter, and the days have been getting longer. Not that the kids ever see night and day, because the rooms in the block don't have any windows. Today is the day when the two finally balance. The night and the day are both exactly 12 hours long. And that makes it kind of a magical day, Miss Justineau says. In olden times, it meant the long dark of winter was finally over, and things would start growing again and the world would be renewed. The solstice was the promise that the days wouldn't just keep on getting shorter until they disappeared altogether. The equinox was the day when the promise was fulfilled. Miss Justineau picks up the big bag and puts it on the table. And I was thinking about this, she says slowly, knowing they're all watching, knowing that they're aching to see what's in the bag. And it occurred to me that nobody ever showed you, really, what spring is all about. So I climbed over the perimeter fence. Gasps from the children. Region 6 may be mostly cleared, but outside the fence still belongs to the Hungries. As soon as you're out there, they can see you and smell you, and once they get your scent, they're never going to stop following you until they've eaten you. Miss Justineau laughs at the horrified expressions on their faces. Only kidding, she says. There's actually a part of the camp where the soldiers didn't bother to finish clearing when they set up this base. There's lots of wild flowers there. And even a few trees. So? And she pulls the mouth of the bag wide open. I went over there, and I just grabbed what I could find. Would have felt like vandalism before the breakdown, but the wildflowers are doing okay for themselves these days. So I just thought, what the hell? She reaches into the bag and takes something out. It's a sort of stick, long and twisted, with smaller sticks coming off it in all directions. And the smaller sticks have smaller sticks, and so on. So it's a really crazy, complicated shape. And all over it there are these little green dots. But as Miss Justineau turns the stick in her hand, Melanie can see that they're not dots. They bulge right out from the stick, as though they're being forced up from inside it. And some of them are broken. They've split in the middle, and they're sort of peeling into ever so slender green lips and brackets. Anyone know what this is? Miss Justineau asks. Nobody speaks. Melanie is thinking about it hard, trying to match it up with something she's already seen, or maybe been told about in class. She's just about to get it, because the word means what it says. The way the big stick breaks into smaller sticks and again, so there's more and more of them, like breaking down a great big number into the long list of its prime factors. It's a branch, Joanne says. Dummy, 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 Melanie scolds herself. Her rainforest picture is just full of branches. But the real branch looks different somehow. Its shape is more complicated and broken up. Its texture's rougher. You're damn right it's a branch, Miss Justineau agrees. I think it's an alder. A couple of thousand years ago, the people who lived around here would have called this time of year the alder month. They used the bark of the tree for medicine, because it's really rich in something called salicin. It's kind of a natural pain relief drug. She goes around the class, unstrapping the children's right arms from their chairs so that they can hold the branch and look at it right up close. It's kind of ugly, Melanie thinks, but absolutely fascinating. Especially when Miss Justineau explains that the little green balls are buds, and they'll turn into leaves and cover the whole tree in green, as though it's put a summer dress on. But there's a lot more stuff in the bag, and when Miss Justineau starts to unpack it, the whole class stares in awe, because the bag is full of colours, starbursts and wheels and whirls of dazzling brightness that are as fine and complex in their structures as the branches, only much more symmetrical. Flowers. Red campion, Miss Justineau says, holding up a spray that's not red at all but sort of purple, each petal forked into two like the footprint of an animal in a tracking chart Melanie saw once. Rosemary. White fingers and green fingers, all laced together like your hands clasped together in your lap when you're nervous and you don't want to fidget. Daffodils. Yellow tubes like the trumpets angels blow in the old pictures in Miss Justineau's books, but with fringed lips so delicate they move when Miss Justineau breathes on them. Medlar. White spheres in dense clusters, each one made out of overlapping petals that are curved and nested on themselves, and open at one end to show something inside that looks like a tiny model of more flowers. The children are hypnotized. It's spring in the classroom. It's equinox, with the world balanced between winter and summer, life and death, like a spinning ball balanced on the tip of someone's finger. When everyone has looked at the flowers and held them, Miss Justineau puts them in bottles and jars all around the classroom, wherever there's a shelf or a table or a clear surface, so the whole room becomes a meadow. She reads the class some poems about flowers, starting with one by Walt Whitman about lilacs and how spring always comes back again. But Walt Whitman hasn't got very far at all before he's talking about death and offering to give his lilacs to a coffin that he's seen. So Miss Justineau says let's quit while we're ahead and reads Thomas Campion instead. He even has the same name as a flower, Melanie thinks, and she likes his poem a whole lot better. But maybe the most important thing that comes out of this day is that Melanie now knows what date it is. She doesn't want to stop knowing again, so she decides to keep count. She clears a place in her mind just for the date, and every day she goes to that place and adds one. She makes sure to ask Miss Justineau if this is a leap year, which it is. Once she knows that, she's good. Knowing the date is reassuring in some way she can't quite figure out. It's like it gives her a secret power, like she's in control of a little piece of the world. It's not until then that she realises she's never had that feeling before. Chapter 7. Caroline Cordwell is very skilled at separating brains from skulls. She does it quickly and methodically, and she gets the brain out in one piece with minimal tissue damage. She's reached the point now where she could almost do it in her sleep. In fact, it's been 3 nights since she slept, and there's an itchiness behind her eyes that isn't eased by rubbing them. But her mind is clear, with only the very slightest sense of a hallucinatory edge to that clarity. She knows what she's doing. She watches herself do it, approving the virtuosity of her own technique. The first cut is to the rear of the occipital bone, easing her slimmest bone saw into the gap that Selkirk has opened up for her, through the peeled back layers of flesh and between the nubs and buds of exposed muscle. She extends that first cut out to either side, taking care to maintain a straight horizontal line corresponding to the widest part of the skull. It's important to have enough room to work in, so she doesn't squash the brain or leave part of it behind when she takes it out. She journeys on, the bone saw flicking lightly back and forth like the bow of a violin, through the parietal and temporal bones, keeping the same straight line, until she comes at last to the superciliary ridges. At that point, the straight line ceases to matter. Instead, X marks the spot. Dr. Caldwell draws the sword down from top left to bottom right, then up again from bottom left to top right, making two slightly deeper incisions that cross at the midpoint between the subject's eyes, which flicker in rapid saccades, focus and defocus in restless, busy work. The subject is dead, but the pathogen that controls his nervous system isn't even slightly deterred by the loss of a steering consciousness. It still knows what it wants, and it's still the captain of this sinking ship. Dr. Caldwell deepens the intersecting cuts at the front of the skull because the subject's sinuses, in effect, create a double thickness of bone there. Then she puts down the bone saw and picks up a screwdriver, part of a set that her father received as a free gift from the Reader's Digest Publishing Company when he subscribed to some of their products more than 30 years previously. The next part is delicate and difficult. She probes the cuts with the tip of the screwdriver, levering them further open where she can, but making sure that she never inserts the screwdriver's business end deep enough to damage the brain beneath. The subject sighs, although he has no need for oxygen anymore. "Soon be done," Dr. Caldwell says, and feels foolish a half second later. This is not a conversation or a shared experience of any kind. She sees Selkirk watching her, with a slightly guarded expression. Piqued, she snaps her fingers and points, making Selkirk pick up the bone saw and hand it back to her. Now she's engaged in a ballet of infinitesimal increments, testing the skull with the tip of the screwdriver to see where it moves, going in with the saw again where there's resistance, and gradually levering the whole top of the skull loose in one piece. Which is the hardest part. Now done. Lifting the front of the calvarium, Caldwell snips loose cranial nerves and blood vessels with a number 10 pencil grip scalpel, lifting the brain gently from the front as it comes free. Once the spinal cord is exposed, she cuts that too. But she doesn't try to lift the brain all the way out. Now that it's free, she hands the scalpel back to Selkirk and accepts a pair of snub-nosed pliers, with which she removes, very carefully, the few jagged edges of bone that stand proud from the rim of the hole she's made in the skull. It's all too easy to gouge troughs in the brain as you lift it through that makeshift trapdoor, and then it's of such limited use you might as well throw it away. Now she lifts it. With both hands, from underneath, teasing it up with the tips of her fingers through the opening in the skull without ever letting it touch the edge, and sets it down, with great care, on the cutting board. Subject number 22, whose name was Liam, if you accept the idea of giving these things a name, continues to stare at her, his eyes tracking her movements. It doesn't mean he's alive. Dr. Caldwell takes the view that the moment of death is the moment where the pathogen crosses the blood-brain barrier. What's left, though its heart may beat some 10 or 12 times per minute, and though it speaks and can even be christened with a boy's name or a girl's name, is not the host. It's the parasite. And the parasite, whose needs and tropisms are very different from human needs and human instincts, is a diligent steward. It continues to run a wide range of bodily systems and networks without reference to the brain, which is just as well, seeing as the brain is about to be cut into thin slices and set between glass plates. "Shall I take the rest of the spinal cord out?" Selkirk asks. She has that tentative, pleading tone in her voice that Caldwell despises. She's like a beggar on a street corner asking not for money or food, but for mercy. Don't make me do anything nasty or difficult. Dr. Caldwell, who's prepping the razor, doesn't even look around. Sure, she says. Go ahead. She's brusque in her manner, even surly, because this part of the procedure, more than any other, hurts her professional pride. If anything were ever to make her shake her fist at the untenanted heavens, it would be this. She's read about how brains were sliced and mounted in the good old days, before the breakdown. There was a device called an Atlum, an automated lathe ultramicrotome, which with its diamond blade could be calibrated to slice brains into perfect cross-sections of single neuron thickness. 30,000 slices per millimetre, give or take. The best that Dr. Caldwell's guillotine can manage, without smearing and crushing the fragile structures she wants to look at, is about 10 slices per millimetre. Mention Robert Edwards to Dr. Caldwell. Mention Elizabeth Blackburn, Gunter Blobel, or Carol Greider, or any cellular biologist who ever got the Nobel Prize, and see what she says. More often than not, she'll say, "I bet he, or she, had an automated lathe ultramicrotone, and a team 0.5 transmission electron microscope, and a live cell imaging system, and an army of grad students, interns and lab assistants to handle the dull routine of processing so the Nobel laureate would be free to waltz in the moonlight with his frigging muse." Dr. Caldwell is trying to save the world, and she feels like she's wearing oven mitts instead of surgical gloves. She had her chance once to do it in style, but nothing came of it. And here she is, alone, but complete unto herself, still fighting. Selkirk gives a bleat of dismay, jolting Caldwell out of her profitless reverie. "Spinal cord is severed, Doctor. Level with the 12th vertebra." "Toss it," Dr. Caldwell mutters. She doesn't even try to hide her contempt. Chapter 8. 117 days have passed since the day when Liam and Marcia were taken away and didn't come back. Melanie continues to think about it and worry at it, but she still hasn't asked Miss Justineau, or anyone else, what happened to them. The closest she's come is to ask Mr. Whittaker what two little ducks means. She remembers Dr. Caldwell saying those words on the day when it all happened. Mr. Whittaker is having one of those up-and-down days when he brings his bottle into class, the bottle full to the brim with the medicine that makes him first better, and then worse. Melanie has watched this strange and mildly disturbing process enough times that she can predict its course. Mr. Whittaker comes into class nervous and irritable, determined to find fault with everything the children say or do. Then he drinks the medicine, and it spreads through him like ink through water. It was Miss Justineau who showed them what that looks like. His body relaxes, losing its ticks and twitches. His mind relaxes too, and for a little while he's gentle and patient with everyone. If he could only stop at that point, it would be wonderful. But he keeps drinking, and the miracle is reversed. It's not that Mr. Whittaker gets grumpy again. What he gets is something worse, something quite awful, that Melanie doesn't have a name for. He seems to sink in on himself in total misery, and at the same time try to shrink away from himself, as though there's something inside him that's too nasty to touch. Sometimes he cries and says he's sorry. Not to the children, but to someone else who isn't really there and whose name keeps changing. Knowing this cycle well, Melanie times her question to coincide with the expansive phase. "What might those two little ducks be?" she asks Mr. Whittaker, that Dr. Caldwell mentioned. Why did she mention them right then, on the day when she took Marcia and Liam away? "It's from a game called Bingo," Mr. Whittaker tells her, his voice only a little blurred around the edges. What might those two little ducks be? She asks Mr. Whittaker, that Dr. Caldwell mentioned. Why did she mention them right then, on the day when she took Marcia and Liam away? It's from a game called Bingo, Mr. Whittaker tells her, his voice only a little blurred around the edges. In the game, each player gets a card full of numbers from 1 to 100. The caller calls out numbers at random, and the first player to have all their numbers called wins a prize. Are the two little ducks one of the prizes? Melanie asks him. No, Melanie, they're one of the numbers. It's a sort of code. Every number has a special phrase or group of words attached to it. Two little ducks is 22 because of the shapes the numbers make on the page. Look. He draws them on the whiteboard. They look just like ducks swimming along. You see? Melanie thinks they look more like swans, actually, but the game of bingo doesn't interest her very much. So all Dr. Caldwell was doing was saying 22 twice, once in ordinary numbers, and once in this code, saying two times over that she was choosing Liam instead of someone else. Choosing him for what? Melanie thinks about numbers. Her secret language uses numbers. Different numbers of fingers held up with your right hand and your left hand, or your right hand twice if your left hand is still tied to the chair. That makes 6 times 6 different combinations, because holding up no fingers is a signal too. Enough for all the letters of the alphabet, and special signs for all the teachers and Dr. Caldwell and Sergeant, plus a question mark and a sign that means I'm joking. 117 days means that it's summer now. Maybe Miss Justina will bring the world into the classroom again. We'll show them what summer looks like, the way she did with spring. But Miss Justina is different these days, when she's with the class. She sometimes forgets what she's saying, breaks off mid-sentence and goes quiet for a long time before she starts up again, usually with something completely different. She reads from books a lot more, and organises games and sing-songs a lot less. Maybe Miss Justineau is sad for some reason. That thought makes Melanie both desperate and angry. She wants to protect Miss Justineau, and she wants to know who'd be so horrible as to make her sad. If she could find out who it was, she doesn't know what she'd do to them. But it would make them very sorry. And when she starts to think about who it might be, there's really only one name that comes into her mind. And here he is, walking into the classroom now at the head of half a dozen of his people, his scowling face half crossed out by the wobbly diagonal of his scar. He puts his hands on the handles of Melanie's chair, swivels it around and pushes it out of the classroom. He does it really fast and jerky, the way he does most things. He wheels the chair right past the door of Melanie's cell. Then he backs it in, pushing the door open with his bottom, and spins the chair around so sharply and suddenly it makes Melanie dizzy. Two of Sergeant's people come in behind him, but they don't go anywhere near the chair. They stand to attention and wait until Sergeant nods permission. One of them covers Melanie with his handgun, while the other starts to undo the straps, the neck strap first and from behind. Melanie meets Sergeant's gaze, feeling something inside her clench like a fist. It's Sergeant's fault that Miss Justineau is sad. It has to be, because she only started to be sad after Sergeant got mad with her and told her she'd broken the rules. Look at you, he says to Melanie now, face all screwed up like a tragedy mask. Like you've got feelings. Jesus Christ. Melanie scowls at him, as fierce as she can get. If I had a box full of all the evils of the world, she tells him, I'd open it just a little way and push you inside. Then I'd close it again for always. Sergeant laughs, and there's surprise in the laugh, like he can't believe what he just heard. Well, shit, he says. I'd better make sure you never get hold of a box. Melanie is outraged that he took the biggest insult she could think of and laughed it off. She casts around desperately for a way to raise the stakes. She loves me, she blurts. That's why she stroked my hair, because she loves me and wants to be with me. And all you do is make her sad, so she hates you. She hates you as bad as if you were a hungry. Sergeant stares at her, and something happens in his face. It's like he's surprised, and then he's scared, and then he's angry. The fingers of his big hands pull back slowly into fists. He puts his hands on the arms of the chair and slams it back against the wall. His face is very close to Melanie's, and it's all red and twisty. I will fucking dismantle you, you little roach, he says in a choking voice. Sergeant's people are watching all this with anxious looks on their faces. They look like they think there's something that they should be doing, but they're not sure what it is. One of them says, Sergeant Parks, but then doesn't say anything else. Sergeant straightens up and steps back, makes a gesture that's halfway to being a shrug. We're done here, he says. She's still strapped in, says the other one of Sergeant's people. Too bad, says Sergeant. He throws the door open and waits for them to move, looking at one of them and then the other until they give up and leave Melanie where she is and go out through the door. Sweet dreams, kid, Sergeant says. He slams the door shut behind him, and she hears the bolts shoot home. One, two, three. Chapter 9. I'm concerned about your objectivity, Dr. Caldwell tells Helen Justineau. Justineau doesn't answer, but her face probably says, excuse me, all by itself. We're examining these subjects for a reason, Caldwell goes on. You wouldn't necessarily know it from the level of support we get, but our research program is incalculably important. Justineau still says nothing, and Caldwell seems to feel a need to fill the vacuum, maybe to overfill it. It's no exaggeration to say that our survival as a race might depend on our figuring out why the infection has taken a different course in these children, as opposed to its normal progression in the other 99.999% of subjects. Our survival, Helen. That's what we're playing for. Some hope of a future, some way out of this mess. They're in the lab, Caldwell's workshop of filthy creation, which Justineau doesn't often visit. She's only here now because Caldwell summoned her. This base and this mission may both be under military jurisdiction, but Caldwell is still her boss, and when that call comes, she has to answer. Has to leave the classroom and visit the torture chamber. Brains in jars. Tissue cultures in which recognisably human limbs and organs spawn lumpy cloudscapes of grey fungal matter. A hand and forearm, child-sized, of course, flayed and opened. The flesh pinned back and slivers of yellow plastic inserted to prise apart muscle and leave interior structures open to examination. The room is cluttered and claustrophobic, the blinds always drawn down to keep the outside world at a clinically optimum distance. The light, pure white, unforgivingly intense, comes from fluorescent tubes that lie flush with the ceiling. Caldwell is preparing microscope slides, using a razor blade to take slivers of tissue from what looks like a tongue. Justineau doesn't flinch. She takes care to look at everything that's there, because she's a part of this process. Pretending not to see would, she believes, take her past some point of no return, past the event horizon of hypocrisy, into a black hole of solipsism. Christ, she might turn into Caroline Caldwell. Who almost got to be part of the great big Save the Human Race think tank back in the early days of what came to be called the breakdown. A couple of dozen scientists, secret mission, secret government training, the biggest deal in a rapidly shrinking world. Many were called and few were chosen. Caldwell was one of the ones at the front of the line when the doors closed in her face. Does that still sting, all these years later? Is that what drove her crazy? It was so long ago now that Justineau has forgotten most of the details. 3 years after the first wave of infections, when the free-falling societies of the developed world hit what they mistakenly thought was bottom. In the UK, the numbers of infected appeared briefly to have stabilised, and 100 initiatives were discussed. Beacon was going to find the cure, reclaim the cities, and restore a much-longed-for status quo. In that strange false dawn, 2 mobile labs were commissioned. They weren't built from scratch, there wasn't time enough for that. Instead, they were jury-rigged quickly and elegantly by refitting 2 vehicles already owned by the London Natural History Museum. Intended to house travelling exhibitions, Charles Darwin and Rosalind Franklin, Charlie and Rosie, now became huge roving research stations. Each was the length of an articulated truck and almost twice as wide. Each was fitted with state-of-the-art biology and organic chemistry labs, together with berths for a crew of 6 researchers, 4 guards and 2 drivers. They also benefited from a range of refurbishments approved by the Department of Defence, including the fitting of caterpillar treads, inch-thick external armour, and both forward and rear-mounted field guns and flamethrowers. The Great Green Hopes, as they were called, were unveiled with as much fanfare as could be mustered. Politicians hoping to be the heroes of the coming human renaissance made speeches over them and broke champagne bottles off their bows. They were launched with tears and prayers and poems and exordiums into oblivion. Things fell apart really quickly after that. The respite was just a chaos artifact created by powerful forces momentarily cancelling each other out. The infection was still spreading, and global capitalism was still tearing itself apart, like the 2 giants eating each other in the Dali painting called Autumn Cannibalism. No amount of expertly choreographed PR could prevail, in the end, against Armageddon. It strolled over the barricades and took its pleasure. Nobody ever saw those hand-picked geniuses again. They're left with the second division, the substitutes bench, the runners-up. Only Caroline Caldwell can save us now. God fucking help us. "You didn't bring me here to be objective," Justineau reminds her superior, and she's surprised that her voice sounds almost level. "You brought me in because you wanted psychological evaluations to supplement the raw physical data you get from your own research. If I'm objective, I'm worthless to you. I thought my engaging with the children's thought processes was the whole point." Caldwell makes a non-committal gesture, purses her lips. She wears lipstick every day, despite its scarcity, and she wears it to good effect, puts up an optimal front to the world. In an age of rust, she comes up stainless steel. "Engaging," she says. "Engaging is fine, Helen. I'm talking about something beyond that." She nods towards a stack of papers on one side of the work surfaces, in among the petri dishes and stacked slide boxes. "That top sheet there, that's a routine file copy of a request you made to Beacon. You wanted them to impose a moratorium on physical testing of the subjects." Justineau has no answer, apart from the obvious one. "I asked you to send me home," she says, "on 7 separate occasions. You refused. You were brought here to do a job. The job still remains to be done. I choose to hold you to your contract." "Well, then you get the whole deal," Justineau says. "If I was back in Beacon, maybe I could look the other way. If you keep me here, you have to put up with minor inconveniences like me having a conscience." Caldwell's lips narrow down to a single ruled line. She reaches out and touches the handle of her razor, moves it so that it's parallel with the edge of the table. "No," she says, "I really don't. I define the programme and you're part in it. And that part is still a necessary one, which is why I'm taking the time to talk to you now. I'm concerned, Helen. You seem to have made a fundamental error of judgment, and unless you can step away from it, it will taint all your observations of the subjects. You'll be worse than useless. An error of judgment. Justin, who considers a remark about the reliability of Caldwell's own judgment, but trading insults isn't going to win this. Isn't it apparent to you by now, she says instead, that the children's responses are all within the normal human range, and mostly displaced towards the top end of that range? You're talking cognitively? No, Caroline, I'm talking across the board. Cognitively, emotionally, associatively, the works. Caldwell shrugs. Well, the works would have to include their hardwired reflexes. Anyone who experiences a feeding frenzy when they smell human flesh isn't testing entirely within normal parameters, wouldn't you agree? You know what I mean. Yes, and you know that you're wrong. Caldwell hasn't raised her voice, shows no sign of being angry or impatient or frustrated. She might be a teacher, exposing a pupil's sophomoric lapse of logic so that they can correct and improve. The subjects aren't human, they're hungries. High-functioning hungries. The fact that they can talk may make them easier to empathise with, but it also makes them very much more dangerous than the animalistic variety we usually encounter. It's a risk just having them here, inside the parameter, which is why we were told to set up so very far from Beacon. But the information that we're hoping to gain justifies that risk. It justifies anything. Justinu laughs, a harsh and ugly spasming of breath that hurts her coming out. It's got to be said. There's no way around it. You carved up two children, Caroline, and you did it without anaesthetic. They don't respond to anaesthetic. Their brain cells have a lipid fraction so small that alveolar concentrations never cross the action threshold, which in itself ought to tell you that the subject's ontological status is to some extent in doubt. You're dissecting kids, Justinu repeats. My God, you're like the Wicked Witch in a fairy tale. I know you've got form. You cut up seven of them, didn't you? Back before I got here. Before you requisitioned me. You stopped because there were no surprises. You weren't finding anything you didn't already know. But now, for some reason, you're ignoring that fact and starting up again. So, yeah, I went over your head because I was hoping there might be somebody sane up there. Justin, who registers her own voice, realizes that she's too loud and too shrill. She falters into silence, waits to be told that she's cashiered. It will be a relief. It will all be over. She'll have taken it as far as she can, and she'll have lost, and they'll send her away. It will become somebody else's problem. Of course, she'd save the kids if she could, if there was any way, but you can't save people from the world. There's nowhere else to take them. I'd like you to see something, Caldwell says. Justinu doesn't have any answer. She watches with an eerie sense of dislocation as Caldwell crosses to another part of the lab, comes back with a glass fish tank in which she's set up one of her tissue cultures. It's an older one, with several years of growth. The tank is about 18 inches by 12 by 10 inches high, and its interior is completely filled with a dense mass of fine, dark grey strands. Like plague-flavoured candy floss, Justinu thinks. It's impossible even to tell what the original substrate was. It's just lost in the toxic froth that has sprouted from it. This is all one organism, Caldwell says, with pride and perhaps even a perverse kind of affection in her voice. She points, and we know now what kind of organism it is. We finally figured it out. I thought it was pretty obvious, Justinu says. If Caldwell hears the sarcasm, she doesn't appear to be troubled by it. "Oh, we knew it was a fungus," she agrees. "There was an assumption at first that the hungry pathogen had to be a virus or a bacterium. The swift onset and the multiple vectors of infection seemed to point in that direction. But there was plenty of evidence to support the fungal hypothesis. If the breakdown hadn't come so quickly, the organism would have been isolated within a matter of days. As it was, we had to wait a little while. In the chaos of those first few weeks, a great many things were lost. Any testing that was being done on the first victims was curtailed when those victims attacked, overpowered, and fed on the physicians and scientists who were examining them. The exponential spread of the plague ensured that the same scenario was played out again and again. And, of course, the men and women who could have told us the most were always, by the nature of their work, the most exposed to infection. Caldwell speaks in the dry, inflectionless tone of a lecturer, but her expression hardens as she stares down at the thing that is both her nemesis and the focal point of her waking life. "If you grow the pathogen in a dry, sterile medium," she says, "it will eventually reveal its true nature. But its growth cycle is slow, quite astonishingly slow. In the hungries themselves, it takes several years for the mycelial threads to appear on the surface of the skin, where they look like dark grey veins or fine mottling. In agar, the process is slower still. This specimen is 12 years old, and it's still immature. The sexual or germinating structures, sporangia or hymenia, have yet to form. That's why it's only possible to catch the infection from the bite of a hungry or direct exposure to its bodily fluids. After 2 decades, the pathogen still hasn't spored. It can only bud asexually in a nutrient solution. Ideally, human blood." "Why are you showing me this?" Justinu demands. "I've read the literature." "Yes, Helen," Caldwell agrees, "but I wrote it. And I'm still writing it. Through the cultures I took from badly decayed hungries, cultures like this one, I was able to establish that the hungry pathogen is an old friend in a new suit. Ophiocordyceps unilateralis. We encountered it first as a parasite on ants, and its behaviour in that context made it notorious. Nature documentaries dwelled on every lurid detail." Caldwell proceeds to dwell on every lurid detail, but she doesn't really need to. Back when she first identified the hungry pathogen as a mutant cordyceps, she was so happy that she just had to share. She persuaded Beacon to approve an educational program for all base personnel. They filed into the canteen in groups of 20, and Caldwell started the show by playing a short extract from a David Attenborough documentary, Dateline 20 years or so before breakdown. Attenborough's perfectly pitched voice, honey from an English country garden, described with incongruous gentleness how Ophiocordyceps spores lie dormant on the forest floor in humid environments, such as the South American rainforest. Foraging ants pick them up without noticing because the spores are sticky. They adhere to the underside of the ant's thorax or abdomen. Once attached, they sprout mycelial threads which penetrate the ant's body and attack its nervous system. The fungus hotwires the ant. Images on the screen of ants convulsing, trying in vain to scrape the sticky spores off their body armour with quick, spasmodic sweeps of their legs. Doesn't help. The spores have commenced digging in, and the ant's nervous system is starting to flood with foreign chemicals, expert forgeries of its own neurotransmitters. The fungus gets into the driving seat, puts its foot on the accelerator and drives the ant away, makes it climb to the highest place it can reach, to a leaf 50 feet or more above the forest floor, where it digs in with its mandibles, locks itself immovably to the leaf's spinal ridge. The fungus spreads through the ant's body and explodes out of its head. A phallic sporangium skull-fucking the dying insect from the inside. The sporangium sheds thousands of spores, and falling from that great height they spread for miles. Which, of course, is the point of the exercise. Thousands of species of cordyceps, each one a specialist, bonded uniquely with a particular species of ant. But at some point, a cordyceps came along that was a lot less finicky. It jumped the species barrier, then the genus, family, order, and class. It clawed its way to the top of the evolutionary tree, assuming for a moment that evolution is a tree and has a top. Of course, the fungus might have had a helping hand. It might have been grown in a lab for any number of reasons, coaxed along with gene splicing and injected RNA. Those were very big jumps. This, Caldwell is saying, tapping the sealed lid of the fish tank, is what's inside the subject's heads, inside their brains. When you walk into that classroom, you think you're talking to children. But you're not, Helen. You're talking to the thing that killed the children. Justin, who shakes her head. I don't believe that, she says. I'm afraid it doesn't matter what you believe. They exhibit behavioural responses that have no bearing on the fungus's survival. Caldwell shrugs offhandedly. Yes, of course they do. For the moment, waste not, want not. Ophiocordyceps doesn't devour the entire nervous system all in one go. But if one of those things you think of as your pupil smells human flesh, human pheromones, it's the fungus that you'll be dealing with. The first thing it does is to consolidate its control of the motor cortex and the feeding reflex. That's how it propagates itself, in saliva, mainly. The bite gives nourishment to the host and spreads the infection at the same time, hence the extreme caution we take in the handling of the test subjects. And hence, she sighed, the need for this lecture. Justin, who feels an intense desire to assert herself against a judgment that's already been made. She takes hold of the lid of the fish tank and wrenches it open. Caldwell gives a wordless yell as she recoils, hand clasped to her mouth. Then she thinks about what she's doing and lowers her hand. She glares at Justinu, her cool detachment holed below the waterline. That was very stupid, she says. But not dangerous, Justinu points out. You said it yourself, Caroline. No sex organs yet, no spores, no way for the fungus to spread in air. It needs blood and sweat and spit and tears, you see? You're just as likely as anyone to make a false assessment, to see a risk where there really isn't any. It's a poor analogy, Caldwell says. There's an edge in her voice you could part a hair on. And overestimating risk isn't even an issue here. The danger, all the danger, lies in ignoring it. Caroline, Justin, who tries one last time, I'm not arguing that we should stop the program, just that we should switch to other methods. Caldwell smiles, brittle, precise. I'm open to other methods, she tells Justinu. That's why I asked for a developmental psychologist to join the team in the first place. The smile fades out, an inevitable ebb tide. My team. Your methods are adjuncts to mine, called on when I need them. You don't dictate our approach, and you don't talk to Beacon over my head. Has it occurred to you, Helen, that we're here under military rather than civilian jurisdiction? Do you ever think about that? Not much, Justin admits. Well, you should. It makes a difference. If I do decide that you're compromising my programme, and if I inform Sergeant Parks of that fact, you won't be sent home. She fixes Justin with a stare that's incongruously gentle and concerned. You'll be shot. Silence falls between them. I am interested in what's going on inside their heads, Caldwell says at last. Mostly, I find I can determine that by examining physical structures under a microscope. When I can't, I look at your reports. And what I expect to find there is clear rational assessment, building to an occasional well-justified conjecture. Do you understand that? A long pause. Yes, Justinu says. Good. In that case, and as a starting point, I'd like you to list the subjects in order of their importance to your assessments, as of now. Tell me which ones you still need to observe and how much you need them. I'll try to take your priorities into account when I'm choosing the next subjects to be brought over here and dissected. We need masses of comparative measurements. We're stonewalled. And the only thing I can think of that might bring us any new insights is bulk data. I want to process half the cohort in the next 3 weeks. Justinu can't take that blow without flinching. Half the class, she repeats faintly. But that's... Caroline... Jesus! Half the cohort, Caldwell insists. Half of our remaining supply of test subjects. The class is a maze you've built for them to run through. Don't reify it into something that merits consideration on its own account. I need the list by Sunday, but earlier is better. We'll begin processing on Monday morning. Thanks for your time, Helen. If there's anything that I or Dr. Selkirk can do to help, just let us know. But the final decision is yours, of course. We won't encroach on that. Justinu finds herself in the open air, walking in some random direction. Sunlight hits her face, and she swerves away from it. Her face is hot enough already. Half of our remaining. Her mind collides with the words, sends them careening out of reach. Another time she might admire Caldwell's brutal honesty about her own failings. We're stonewalled. She identifies with the project so completely that vanity on her own account is impossible. On the other hand, the final decision is yours. That's pure sadism. Serve at my altar, Helen. You even get to choose the sacrifices, so how cool is that? Half of... Things will fall apart, and the centre won't hold. Perforated with fears and insecurities, the class will tear along every fold. They'll finally ask the questions Justinu can't answer. She'll have to choose between confession and evasion, and either one will probably kick her right over the edge of the catastrophe curve. Which is maybe where she deserves to be. Child killer. Facilitator of mass murder, smiling a Judas smile as she ticks the boxes. The thought of Parks putting a gun to her head has its own peculiar appeal at that moment. Then she walks right into him, hard enough that they both stagger. He recovers first, grips her shoulders lightly to steady her. Hey, he says. You all right, Miss Justinu? His broad, flat face, made asymmetrical and inconceivably ugly by the scar, radiates friendly solicitude. Justinu pulls out of his grasp, her own face twisting as her anger finds its level. Parks blinks, seeing the visceral emotion, uncertain where it came from or where it might be going. I'm fine, Justinu says. Get out of my way, please. The sergeant gestures over his shoulder towards the fence at his back. Sentry clocked some movement in the woods over there, he says. We don't know if it's Hungry's or what it is. Either way, perimeter's off limits for now. Sorry. That was why I tried to head you off. Movements in the middle distance, in the direction where he's pointing, distracts her for a second, so that she has to wrench her attention back. She faces him, trying to take a breath that's long and level, trying to pull all the slopping emotions back inside so he won't see them in her face. She doesn't want to be understood by this man, even on such a superficial level. And thinking about what he's already seen, what he might know or thinks he knows of her, makes her suddenly see the timing of her humiliation in a new perspective. When Parks saw her breaking the no-contact rule, he threatened to put her on a charge. But then nothing happened. Until now. Parks went and told tales about her to Caroline Cordwell. She's sure of it. The four-month gap between the Melanie incident and this dressing down doesn't dent that conviction. Things percolate slowly through bureaucracies. Take their own sweet time. She has to fight the urge to punch Parks full in his ruin of a face, maybe find the flaw, the pressure point that will make him crumble into pieces and be gone out of her life. "I'm still here, Sergeant," she tells him, stung into defiance. "You took your best shot, and all she did was smack my hand and set me extra homework." Park's forehead creases, in the areas where it still can, where the scar tissue doesn't render it permanently creased. "Sorry," he says. "Don't be." She starts to walk around him, remembers that she can't keep going in this direction and turns, so she's broadside onto him for a moment. "I didn't take any shot at all," the sergeant says quickly. "I don't report to Dr. Caldwell, if that's what you think." He sounds like he means it. He sounds like he really wants her to believe him. "Well, you should," Justinu says. "It's an excellent way of pissing me off. Don't mess up your perfect scores, Sergeant." Something like distress shows in Park's face now. "Look," he says. "I'm trying to help you." "Seriously?"
"To help me?"
"Exactly. I've clocked up a lot of years in the field, and I've survived more grab-bagger sweeps than almost anyone. I mean, hardcore shit. Inner city." "So?" Parks shrugs massively, is silent for a second as though he's hit the limits of his vocabulary, which doesn't strike her as too unlikely. "So I know what I'm talking about," he says at last. "I know the Hungries. You don't live that long outside the fence unless you work out the moves, what you can get away with, and what's going to get you killed." Justinu lets her utter indifference show in her face. She knows somehow that it will get deeper into him than any show of anger could. His agitation shows her away to a high ground of cold disdain. "I'm not outside the fence." "But you're handling them. You're dealing with them every day, and you're not keeping your guard up. Shit, you had your hands on that thing. You touched it." He falters on the words. "Yes," Justinu agrees. "I did. Shocking, isn't it?"
"Stupid."
Parks shakes his head as if to dislodge a fly that's landed on him.
"Miss Justinu. Helen. The regs are there for a reason. If you take them seriously, they'll save you. From your own instincts as much as anything."
She doesn't bother to answer. She just stares him down.
"Okay," Parks says. "Then I'll have to take this into my own hands."
"You'll have to what?"
"It's my responsibility."
"Into your own hands?"
"This base's security is my..."
"You want to lay hands on me, Sergeant?"
"I won't touch a hair on your head," he says, exasperated. "I can keep order in my own damn house."
And she reads it, suddenly, in his face. She can see that he's talking around something, something that's fresh in his mind.
"What have you done?" she demands. "Nothing."
"What have you done?"
"Nothing that concerns you."
He's still talking when she walks away, but it's not hard to shut the words out. They're just words. By the time she gets to the classroom block, she's running. Chapter 10.
When there's nothing to do, and you can't even move, time goes a lot more slowly. Melanie's legs and her left arm, still strapped into the chair, have cramped agonizingly. But that happened a long time ago, and now the pain of the cramp has faded,